You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And then he looked, section 318. He just looked up in the back out of the wall of this arena to see a bunch of empty seats. There's like two people sitting in the back. Because like I said, the doors had just opened. They're patting everybody down. There's nobody in there.
So it's like, section 318, you guys are louder than the PA up there.
And you can see two guys looking at each other like, what? But I do believe my favorite one, however, was he said, "Well, let me tell you something. I want to sing this song to all the guys out there, because Eddie's Kiss is gonna be sleeping with your girlfriend after the show. It's called Tears of Fire." You know, like that's it was ridiculous.
Hello, welcome to another episode of 2020. My name is Corey Peza, here as always with the very bright Ben Goodman and Siobhan Cronin on the road somewhere in America with some sort of internet connection, we hope.
Hotspotting their phone.
Let's hope.
Yeah.
Hotspotting from the phone somewhere in New Mexico, so it might not make it.
Today, we're super pumped to talk to someone who doesn't do a lot of interviews. But
I had to bag him. I had to literally stalk this motherfucker.
Yes, Ben is our resident, like, stalker.
And I put Siobhan up to it. I'm like, Siobhan, resident why aren't you doing it? She's like, I'm messaging him. Not enough.
She's on tour. She's busy. But Matt Bichon of Shadows Fall, Living Wreckage, Act of Defiance, ton of great bands, ton of great stories, an amazing perspective on the music industry, and great stories as well. So without taking up too much of Siobhan's internet, let's get right into it on 2020'd. Part one with Matt. Check it out.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Benny Goodman, and I just wanted to say hello with my shirt. So if you're not subscribed to YouTube, 2020-D.com, 2020, I'm here with my compatriots, my cohorts, my friends, my fellow touring people like Siobhan Cronin of Star Set and Corey Peza touring
fellow
our basements.
Fellow touring people, where have you toured, Ben?
Like from my basement to your basement.
Yeah.
Our basements. We were up all night.
He has actually toured into my basement once.
Okay,
that's true. He did tour into my basement once.
It's true. And then, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce, and you heard him already, one of my favorite people on the planet, and he's a recluse. He doesn't come out of his shell, but he did tonight. Mr. Matt Bichon, known as Tim Osmond, from Shadows Fall, Act of Defiance, and the brand new badass, may I add, Living Wreckage. How are you, man?
I'm all right. Can't complain.
Is that like radio?
I mean, I can complain. I've got.
I think
like
we all can complain.
Old guy problems. I have the like sciatica going on and my herniated discs and things. I'm serious. I could barely walk today, but here I am.
Oh my gosh!
I feel you, dude. I feel like I'm going to die, and you're doing a Shadows Fall reunion. Like, how are you going to survive with a sciatica, man?
I'm more concerned about how I'm going to survive it. Relearning how to play guitar. I've been playing bass for so long. I haven't really played
played
a guitar in a long time. I mean, I play guitar in a cover band, but we do like, you know, like some like 90s stuff. We do like some Godsmack and some things like that. But like, you know, it's not Shadows Fall stuff. So totally different world. So jumping back onto that train is going to be.
Well, it's interesting though, because new metal, I feel like, or the not new metal, but the metal that is new now, I feel like is just bass, except they call it guitar. Like in Siobhan's band, they play in drop E. So it's like
pretty wild. That's a baritone guitar though.
Yeah. Aren't you basically just playing the same things that they're playing now, except you're calling it bass?
Maybe. I don't know. What is happening? What is happening right now?
Oh, well, that's just a taste of what you have to expect
it's
in the next.
Worse.
Right.
Oh, I can't wait.
We've lost every listener.
Well, anyway, so Matt, so as the resident classical musician in the group that's not really a metalhead or a rock, well, I guess I play in a rock band now, so I can't make that excuse anymore. But for our listeners who don't know you, can you maybe tell us a little bit about who you are, how you got into playing, how you got into a band, just kind of the the trajectory of your career from beginning to now?
Oh God, well,
that's a big question. I'm sorry, I should have made it a little more specific.
Super loaded question.
The Cliff Notes version.
I don't know.
Fine.
I guess I started probably around 13, 14, like really going for it. But I mean, when I was like really, really young, I wanted to play drums actually. And I grew up in an apartment that had neighbors on both sides. And back then there were no electronic kits or anything like that. So I didn't really have a choice. It was like, either it's too much noise, you got to do something else. So I ended up falling into a guitar around 13 or 14. And of course, James Hetfield is my spirit animal as far as rhythm playing. You know, as a lot of you probably know, I don't really do leads. I'm not that guy. I believe that every band has their space, their part that they do, and they do well. And a lot of times, and most times actually, when you have, you know, two lead players and they trade off each other and everything sounds great, whatever. But I love that house of rhythm. You know, you've got the drums, the bass, that rhythm guitar. You've got, you know, Testament and bands like that where you've just got Eric Peterson in the back holding it down. You know, you've got Skolnick on top, making it happen, you know? And so I always thought that way. So I think that's probably the reason I think that way, is because I did start as a drummer. I always wanted to be. I could maybe play an AC/DC beat now, maybe for about 10 seconds before I lose it. But beyond that, I didn't really stick with it.
That's interesting. Not to stop you, but at what point did you realize that rhythm guitar was more your thing? Because I think this is interesting. Like,
Okay.
So you just always felt you, because my husband's a guitar player and, you know, he's always practicing all this lead stuff. But I mean, I think he loves playing rhythm guitar. And so I think it's, you know, it's interesting to know like what your space is, because there's so many options for what you can do.
Matt, tell me if this is the same thing for you, because I grew up loving James Hetfield. And if it was James Hetfield or Kirk Hammett, I would say James Hetfield all day, because he, when you go see him live, you'd be like, okay, that dude just held down battery, and then Kirk Hammett comes and does his thing. But like playing and singing at the same time, I'm like, I had so much respect for that. So And I always wanted to be the worst person in my own band. So I was like, if I was playing lead guitar, it's probably not a band I want to be in. But I could believe in myself that maybe I could play battery. And that's why like James Hetfield resonated more with me, because I'm like, that's my lane. That's the lane I could stay in, because, you know, Marty Friedman, fucking forget about it. You know,
sure, and it's not so much that I didn't want to learn how to do it or want to do it. I mean, I could probably, you know, pull some stuff off if I tried, but it doesn't interest me enough to want to, because I'd gravitate more towards the meat and potatoes of a song. You know, I'm more about structure and arrangements and putting something together you can sing in the shower. You know, I don't hear anyone out there singing Steve Vai songs in the shower, but you know, they're singing Smells Like Teen Spirit. And I have this all the time. It's like, the song is like the most important thing out of all of that other fluff that comes in. Those are just the parts that make the song. Right. So, if everyone's trying to do the same part to make that song, everyone's stepping on each other and everything else. So I, you know, find your house, live in it, and do what is best you can. And the other thing too, is a lot of times I'll see lead guys where, especially they're doing really, or at least trying to do solid tight rhythms or whatever, and they're alternate picking these things, but you got to downstroke that thing. Just like pop ahead, man. You guys downstroke because it sounds different. You don't think it does. Maybe live you can get away with it because of you know, space and all these other things. But when you're tracking that, you can hear it. You can hear that pick attack and you hear it, and it means something. That's what I do, or at least try to.
That's so interesting. So one other thing you mentioned is you said you fell into guitar around like 13. So what did that mean? Like you saw someone play guitar. Was there guitar in your house? Did you have music around you growing up? Like, how did you gravitate to that?
Not a lot. No one in my family ever played any instruments. For some reason, when I was like three, I wanted to be Animal from the Muppet Show. That was it. You know, I was like, Jay, right now, if you look down here, from Muppet Show drum kit from the 70s.
That's badass.
Right. Dude, now that is
tune into the YouTube, by the way. If no one's watching, Matt just pulled out like a absolutely period correct early 80s Muppet Animal set that I'm sure Paul Lorenzo, our drummer from Lost Symphony, is going, what the fuck?
Well, it's funny because I always tell the story. That was like my favorite gift, and that's what got me going. There's a picture of me, my brother, and my dad on Christmas. And I'm like, I gotta be, Jesus, I was young. It had to be late 70s. Early 80s, and it was I opened that, and there's just this picture. I was like, that's the picture that started everything. And of course, obviously that drum kit's long gone. I was telling a really good friend of mine about that, whatever. And somehow she like found this on eBay for $20 and just gave it to me last week. I was like, that's the best gift I've ever had in my life.
My Jewy mind just said, wow, that seems like a really good deal for an animal 80s.
Oh, you're not kidding. Are there more of them?
Give me two of them, please. I'll sell them.
I can't wait to mount this thing on the wall, you know? wow, we kind of lost track there. Where are we going with this?
I think I remember.
Okay.
That's what I say every
so
day.
No, but well, like I said, it just with guitar, it just kind of happened because I still loved music. I did. Like I said, I grew up around a lot of it. My dad listened to a lot of classic rock and like ZZ Top and things like that. Dire Straits, you got huge into that. And Knopfler is probably my favorite player on the planet. For a lot of reasons. It was out of necessity because of the fact that it had a volume knob and you could turn it down and I wouldn't bother the neighbors that lived next to me in each apartment on either side of where I grew up. So it wasn't because that's what I really wanted to do. It's because I simply couldn't have a drum set. So that's why I like turn into rhythm guitar, because you know, I'm not playing leads because I'm playing with the drums, I'm playing with the beat. I still feel like I'm connected with the drummer without going on top of it. You know what I mean? Does it make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that maybe that's why you, I mean, I when I, you know, hung out with you and you were nice enough to play on Murder of Crows, a song off Chapter 2 from Lost Symphony. And one of the things I did notice is just, so we reunited with you and John, you know, from Shadows Fall. Now you guys are doing a thing again, but you know, we were breaking new ground for a long time. And I just love how much you filled it in. Like you made that song huge. Like if there was like the balls, like there's Jimmy Bell up here just doing his, you know, Jimmy Bell thing. Uh-huh. And like it's outside of space and time. And like that's a whole different thing, because he probably downstrokes all of that too, which is the crazy part. But you just fill it all in. But as a producer, like when I sit in the studio, and I know you have a studio like mine, you think more about like, how do I make this sound fuller? How do I make this sound more badass? How do I make this heavier? And that's more about the rhythm guitars and locking in with the drums than it is like, look, I'm Jeff Loomis, I can just arpeggiate everything with my sweep picking.
Well, I mean, Jeff Loomis can do pretty much anything. So
that's true. That is very true.
Which
or Chris Broderick, your bandmate,
indeed,
who happened to be, what, in my opinion, other than maybe Cacophony, the greatest dual lead, Jeff Loomis, Chris Broderick, and Nevermore. I mean, come on.
It was terrifying watching him warm up there every night. Just straight up scary. I'm like, what is wrong with you, man? What's wrong with you?
What is it like watching Chris Broderick warm up? I want to know, because I mean, as a guy that likes James Hetfield, you're in that school and you're in your lane. What's it like watching the Ferrari next door?
Well, again, it's a different world. It's a different technique. It's a totally different approach, and he is meticulous with rehearsing and practicing, and that's why he is so good, and that's why he is Weez, because he's dedicated to the craft. He loves it. He loves doing it, and he's hands down one of the best I've ever played with. It's just interesting watching him, because it's so out of my wheelhouse what he does. It's just something new for me to see. You know, if I watch rhythm guys warm up all day, I was like, oh, I do that, yeah. I do that. But I watch him, I go, wow, I can't do that at all. That's cool. It's different, you know?
On that thought, and because you mentioned that, you know, you kind of visualize songs almost holistically. You hear like that whole rhythmic aspect and how it's going to kind of come out, and which is the producer mindset that we've talked about with a lot of, you know, instead of just hearing the riff, you're hearing the whole picture. Mm-hmm. With the people you've played with, like how... have you noticed like kind of a typecast type of like role that people fall into when they're thinking about music? Like is those super shredders and those guys that are hyper technical and into the fine details, is there a different like wavelength that they're on versus the people that sit back and the rhythm section that, you know, is much more happy to be in the background as long as everything sounds big and is full? Like, do you notice that difference?
Sometimes it depends on the player. It depends on the band. But like I said, for me, you know, it's always about the song, because that is always the most important thing. You know, if you've got an amazing, you can have the best 10-minute guitar solo, whatever proggy thing in the world, it's never going to be on the radio. It's never going to make any money. It's never going to going to step up. So if you're trying to do this and move forward, yes, do that. And do that because you love it and make those records. But also if you want to try to stay somewhat relevant, you've got to write a song. You want something that hits, something that hits people.
Very relevant to our current band that we're
like sell to your audience. You know, if that's your audience.
Is that what you said with Shadows Fall? Like, let's write the next Britney Spears record. It'll be the low hanging fruit. And then you guys came out.
That's an interesting thing because
like that's the kind of music I feel like my dad would be like, this makes me sick.
With that started to be a thing, that was more of a thing that had no boundaries. So it's kind of the opposite of what I just said, but within holding it within the reins of a song. Now, if you listen to our earlier stuff, it's all over the place. I tried to listen to some of this to even get back in for this reunion gig. Like, oh my God, how am I going to pull this off? Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And we were a little off the wall then, but when I went into it, it was like, well, why can't we? And I came right out of a death metal band, like straight death metal, like 90s death metal band. That's where I came from. And when I met up with John, he was playing in a hardcore band with Adam D from Killswitch. They went to school together, and he had showed him some riffs, and I was like, those are cool. And I wasn't doing the death metal band anymore. Hey, let's do something. But I also said, like, look. Who says we can't have a violin part? Who says we can't have clean singing and death metal vocals? Who says we can't do that? Nobody. There are no rules, you know? And I took a lot of that from a lot of the European bands like My Dying Bride and Course in Flames and all those things where there were a lot of just different things happening that you wouldn't hear in, say, out of a Florida death metal band. Whereas there was more like Florida, set straight.
You know? I don't mean to interrupt you, but when I was in a band called Carve, and I feel like there was a very specific sound, like with Killswitch Engage and Shadows Fall, and like we were kind of doing, but like in Massachusetts, in Massachusetts, a very specific type of metal that it's funny because you go to a concert like Loco Bazooka and you see like 30 awesome bands. You're like, this is just what it's like to be in the local scene. Whereas I realize we were at a very special time where like this new breed of music was coming where you're right. It was very extreme, like, you know, that Pantera heaviness, but then sometimes with like the beautiful choruses and then you could have a violin and then there was shred guitar and it was like put in a different way where it's like almost it was bipolar because before it was like you either sang like Priest or you screamed or yelled like Slayer. You know what I mean? Like there wasn't a lot of middle ground. And I feel like bands like Shadows Fall and bands like Killswitch Engage and All That Remains that came from here, man, that came from here, like developed a sound that have now become like almost, people almost make fun of what Adam D sounds like as cookie cutter metal now because he invented a sound that it's almost become cliche because of how many people copied it.
Right. Well, it's because we all grew up together and we all played the same shows together. What was it? Either in the same band or in different bands doing the same gigs. So we all had the same outside influences like the, you know, bands like At the Gates and In Flames. And even you, so you're, I always said, with some of the melodic metal stuff, I was like, well, it was In Flames. Like, no, that's Boston. You know, that's the first Boston record. That's what that is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Cause if you put some heavy guitars behind the first Boston record, chunk it up, put some death metal vocals over it. That's In Flames, right?
I kind of want to hear that. I kind of want to hear that now. I'm not going to lie.
I feel like that there should be you and John's like drunken party band where you guys just do Boston covers in the style of In Flames. Listen, we know Barry Goudreau.
Yeah,
from Boston. We will fucking call Barry, and if you make that happen, I promise you, I'll convince Barry whatever it takes to get him to play with you.
Well, I would imagine if we're hammered, we wouldn't be able to play Boston songs. Would we? I don't think we'd be able to actually function.
I couldn't play him sober, so God bless.
True.
Oh my God.
Go ahead,
Corey.
Siobhan, your internet causes a delay, so I'll let you take it.
I'm sorry. I'm hotspotting from my phone. Tour life, so
go
here we
go.
Is it one of those days?
No. Oh my God, you're terrible. No, to dovetail on what you were talking about, though, I'm interested to hear what some of your early musical influences were, because a lot of guests we've talked to, you know, they refer to like a first experience they had seeing a famous band on TV or reading about it or going to a concert. And I wonder if you have like a specific memory of kind of that first thing that really caught your attention that was like, okay, this is kind of what I want to make in my life as a musician.
Well, I always remember just loving music regardless of what it was, from even from, you know, Michael Jackson to anything really. But I mean, my first real like record would be probably an Iron Maiden record, you know, and that And of course, it's when you're a kid and you buy those records, you buy them because the album cover's cool, right? That's because that's what you
do. Dude, that's why I got Live After Death. I tell people that all
that's,
the time.
That's the record I'm talking about.
It was Columbia House, and that's they had the a thing, and it was like, it had like a warning on it, whatever. I was like, I have to get this. It had the guy pulling out the chains, and I had no idea what Iron Maiden was. 13 minutes later, I'm like, this, they just taught me that poem I learned in school, like Rhyme of the Ancient. My dad's going to think I'm smart.
Well, we can't have that, can we?
Alexander the Great. I have, like, Steve Harris, when he wrote the second side of Somewhere in Time, like, sat there with, like, Encyclopedia Britannica, and I was like, all right, here are all the bullet points about Alexander the Great. We have 8 minutes and 42 minutes worth of riffs right now.
And what's wrong with that, right?
Nothing!
Exactly.
Iron Maiden was schooling, not in just metal, but in history and culture.
Exactly. And they still are to this very day.
To this very day.
So that was, you know, a huge one. But I was really all over the place, and I still am with what I listen to. I don't have any set rules. When I was really young, I with my grandparents, I listened to a lot of like roots country stuff, like Waylon Jennings and things like that. And all of those things have an impact, whether you realize it or not, they do.
Sure.
And when they come together, I think when I first was like, all right, I'm going to do that is... I saw Metallica on the Injustice for All tour in 89, the Worcester Centrum. Cult was on Sonic Temple at that time, they were opening, so it was the second time through. And I was probably, I don't know, I'm not going to date myself.
Was Jason coming through the monitors?
But no, not quite. But they had the Lady Justice thing that like blew up and fell apart behind
Lars.
Oh, no, it
was nice. I saw the live shit, Binge and Purge. That was like, first off, I think like 89... like that 90, which for me is the height of Metallica. And it's not because I love Cliff Burton, but I think that when Jason came in with a chip on his shoulder and the Injustice for All album, which we all know the live bootlegs are better than the actual album if you go back and compare, because I mean, the album is actually kind of sad by comparison. But that said, that was my favorite time for Metallica. Mm-hmm. I just wonder, like, was there though bass at that time? Was Jason just making the face screaming die?
No, I mean, you could hear it live. I mean, it's just for the record, I you know, it didn't. I guess whatever they did for the record, it was what it was. But that's none of my business. I don't know why I would love to hear that album with bass. You know, and I know it's out there somewhere.
You know, that's actually why Norah Jones wrote that song, was because of Jason.
Is that why?
I don't know why.
I'm going to... Yeah, all right, whatever you say.
We're sorry. I'm just going to throw
that's
that
like,
out
why
there.
Did I agree to this? Like, literally, this is the interview out of, like, the 7 million I've been offered. This is the one I chose. Because I borderline stalked him. I'm like, Siobhan, here's his number. You call him, I'll call him. You call him, I'll call him.
That's how we get
I know,
our
and he, like, he pushes me to, like, bully people into coming on the show. I'm like, I'm not a bully. Can you talk to them?
Hey, Dustin came on last week, and it was great.
Yeah, that's true. But that was just an accident. Once you have everyone sequestered on a bus, it's a lot easier to get them to do things they don't want to do.
That's a good question, Matt. If you were on a bus, what was your favorite thing that you've seen your band or any band that you've been a part of or seen third party that did something that they wouldn't normally do if they were not on the bus?
Wow.
I mean, I know you've toured with Dimebag Darrell, so like we have the
yeah, but how am I supposed to remember any of that?
That's the real question.
I mean,
Jason Costa remembers, so if he can remember, you have no excuse.
But see, Dime used to have a pitcher every day, every show, every day. He'd have a whole pitcher full of Black Tooth Grin. So it had a whole bottle of whiskey and it topped off. And if you even so much as walked by him in the hallway, you had to tug off of it. So even by the time doors were open, everyone was freaking shit-faced. Like, it didn't matter. You had to. He wouldn't let you get away with it. You had to. So, some of that was a blur, but...
I bet.
Good times indeed, though. Good times indeed.
Actually, I want to ask you about this because I saw a picture come up, you know, in my Facebooks. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we've been around for a while where, like, you... It's like sunrise, sunset from Fiddler on the Roof. You see these things come and go. And I saw a picture of you and Joey Jordison and John dressed up like Kiss. And apparently it was like a band and like a thing. So Joey Jordison, the drummer from Slipknot, just left us, which is, again, like, how, why? But I saw that picture and I got to tell you, it made me smile. And I want to know what the fuck was that?
What was that? All right. Well. The three of us just instantly kind of like hit it off. So like those all those times that we toured with Slipknot a few times, that that one big tour in the U.S. was like 10 weeks long. So we had plenty of time to cause trouble.
My God.
We were just always just running around terrorizing people. But we loved, you know, 80s hair metal, and a lot of those guys didn't. So we'd be like, oh, 80s Kiss is the best. All right. Ah, 70s Kiss is the best. No, 80s Kiss. So then as the weeks went on, we would, after the shows, we'd come to the dressing room, like stupid makeup on. We'd have the boom box or something, you know, blast and lick it up. And tears are falling. And just annoying the hell out of the rest of those guys that didn't like the 80s Kiss stuff.
Who was the most annoyed by 80s Kiss of Slipknot? Can we say names? Like, is Corey Taylor going to be angry if we say Corey doesn't like Bruce Kulick?
No, I think Mick might have been pretty upset about it. But he still got the joke. And then I love those guys. Every single one of those dudes is nothing but kind to us. And that was just, that was probably the best tour we've ever done. One of them, for sure. We just kept pushing the joke. And we kept pushing the joke. And Joey's like, look, we'll play the last two shows. Like, what are you talking about? Because eventually there was a rotating opener on that tour. It was Slipknot, Lamb of God, and Child's Fall. And then every four or five shows would be a different band. I think All the Remains did a handful of them. Sworn Enemy did a handful of them. Gizmashi did a handful. And they would rotate. And eventually it got to be where, because of the union rules and the timing, it just, there wasn't enough time to have another band on the tour. So they stopped doing that. So it was just the three of us for probably the second half of the tour. He said, well, look, we got 10 minutes. Let's just do 80s Kiss. What? And then we're thinking, well, what do we call it? I'm like, well, 80s Kiss. What else would you call it, right? That's, of course, that's what you'd call it. So we put this whole thing together. He was Eric Carr, and I was Vinnie Vincent, because if you're going to get away with makeup, the only period you could really do is Vinnie Vincent with the Onk. You know? So I did that, and John was Paul Stanley, and their tour manager, Sully, was Gene. And those last two shows, there's video of it somewhere. Bobby Tongs took a bunch of video of it. He's got it somewhere. I gotta get in touch with him and find it, because it was the best. They had the rigging set up where, like, second show, they put Sully, the tour manager, on the thing, harness, and pulled him up in the air while he was playing bass. And,
shut up!
Oh yeah.
How did it sound like? Like, okay, well, first off, Joey was Eric Carr.
It was horrible. It was horrible.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we got together in the dressing room, like, you know, right before the show. And it was like, oh, we're doing three songs. We did Lick It Up, Tears Are Falling, and Heaven's on Fire.
Oh my God.
And it was only the last two shows of that tour, but the first one of those two shows was in Iowa. So Joey went home and he had a crack mirror Les Paul and a couple other guitars. He's like, we'll go home and get these, and we're going to use these. At one point, he was talking about us even getting our own tour bus for 2 days. Just like rolling, just like, peace, kiss, don't talk to us. You know, like, and we had Willie Adler from Lamb of God on board as our security guy, the squirrel. They have it, cigarettes rolled up in his sleeve, telling local security not to look us in the eye and all this shit. Oh, it was so
fun. My God.
It was the best. It was hysterical. And, you know, our backdrop was just, we had cardboard boxes with, like, gaff tape. It's just like, so you can see in some of those photos, just green gaff tape. It's so stupid. So when we first went out there, the faces on these people, and the doors had just opened, and all these young kids are running right towards the barricade, and they've got their parents with them. And there's, you could see question marks just over people's heads. Like, what is going on?
Did Joey have his full kit up, like full blown, like, Slipknot kit going?
I think he was playing on the Shad kit, actually, because it was part of that back one. So I think he was playing
Jason's ridiculous kit on Bittner's kit.
Yeah, I think he was playing on that one.
Did he do enough
one.
Where, like, people were like, is that Joey?
No, nobody knew. Nobody knew.
They just thought it was a random.
It was such an in and out quick attack. It was only, the set was 10 minutes long. It was just in out. People didn't know what the hell they were looking at. And sometimes you'd see, like, some kids' parents going, oh, I know this song. Yeah. All right. And it was, by no means were we any good. But it was all about the banter, you know. So.
Oh, wait. So wait, who did John do the pedal banter?
Of course he did.
Oh, so did he do it? Wait, I know John, and like, he's a funny dude, but like, I don't see him doing a Paul Stanley banter. Like, what's a John Paul Stanley banter? Like, what can you choose from that? There's a lot of Paul Stanley banter you can choose from.
Well, I mean, one of the good ones, we're in Madison, Wisconsin for the second show, and he comes right out and makes some noise, like, Madison Square Garden! We headline these shows, but we got to be in Japan in like 6 hours, so we're going to play first for you right now. And then he plugged Section 318. He just looked up in the back out of the wall of this arena to see a bunch of empty seats. There's like two people sitting in the back. Because like I said, the doors had just opened. And they're patting everybody down. There's nobody in there. So it was like, Section 318, you guys are louder than the PA up there. And you can see two guys looking at each other like, what? but I do believe my favorite one, however, was he said, "Well, let me tell you something. I want to send this song to all the guys out there because Eddie's Kiss is gonna be sleeping with your girlfriend after the show. It's called Tears of Fire." Yeah, like that's it was ridiculous, and so just for two nights, and we put it out there. I think Joey told his management or something. They're like, "Don't blabbermouth it. We're doing a Kiss tribute." They didn't believe it, and they never posted. Like, this is not real. This is a joke.
You just wiped tears from your eyes, Corey. You made me cry. Matt, you just made me cry. I'm literally crying. I'm laughing so hard because John.
I'm so sad that I missed this. Is really what I'm crying about.
That's hilarious.
People don't know John Denae, who's the other guitarist in Shadows Fall, and he plays in.
Who's on the show? We had him on the show.
Yeah, we had him on the show,
and he's on Lost Symphony. I just thinking about him talking as Paul Stanley with Joey Jordison and
I can
Matt.
Hardly imagine it. That's hilarious. It takes so much charisma to do that with like two people out there.
It was absurd.
Was it cathartic though? Was it like, because nobody knew who you are, so it's like, fuck it, like, we don't care if we fail, like, we want to fail.
Well, hell, we didn't. No one knew who we were anyway. Do I even realize we're watching Joey Jordison right now? Probably not. But they are. But blabbermouth in those places, they didn't even pick it up because they're like, that's not real. That's so stupid that there's no way that's real. And after the first show, the next day they posted it the first morning. They're like, members of Slipknot and Shadows Fall have Kiss tribute band. And I guess apparently it came out to it got back to Gene somehow, maybe through their manager or something. So I heard.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, whoa, finally, an 80s Kiss tribute. What are they called? Like, 80s Kiss.
You're like, I have that trademarked.
And I hope he didn't see any of the footage because then he'd be like, oh my God, they're just picking on us. I was like, we weren't picking on them because we love those songs. I love that shit. But it was just, you know, in the moment, right? Just have fun with it and just do something goofy for tour pranks. And that second show, too, when we had the rigging for the tour manager who was playing bass, was it the third song? We had about 10 minutes before we had to do a Shadows Fall set. So we're all covered in makeup, right? So we throw the guitars down. We run back to the dressing room, take all that shit off, change, and get back out and do the set. Now, during that 10 minutes, the first night, it was just over and we left or whatever. Second night, when it was over, the stage manager, so Slipknot, they pulled him back up and he was just dangling for like 10 minutes. People were throwing shit at him, you know. And he can't see anything without his glasses. Like nothing. He can see nothing without his glasses. So he didn't know what was going on. He's just dangling for like 10 minutes. And they lowered him down about halfway through. They put a cigarette in his mouth, lit it, and then sent him back up again for another 5 minutes. We love you, Sally. That wasn't
me.
Oh,
my God.
It was one of the best like tour pranks like that's ever
I'm so
happened.
Glad I asked you that, dude.
Oh, that's so funny.
It's still one of my favorite stories ever of being on the road. You know, that one's hard to top, really, because we like made it happen. You know, if we had our own bus, that would have been hysterical, because all day it was like, don't look at Eddie's Kiss. So we're playing that whole game like, no, we're the stars here, don't look at us. It was so funny
when you were touring, and we had talked to John about this, about like how the levels of touring, because there's always like the first tours are always like exciting but fucking terrible, and like everything, and then you kind of get to the sweet spot eventually. But what was it like when you first started the chance to tour with a band and be in a rock band?
Oh, it was, I just love to travel and see new places. I still do. I'm not over that. You know, I there's nothing better than having a day off in the middle of Indiana somewhere in some town you've never heard of, and you're in a mall parking lot and you go into an Applebee's on a Wednesday afternoon.
Oh my gosh, I totally relate to that.
Yeah. You know, and just kind of see what's going on, you know, get familiar with your surroundings and stuff. That never gets old. Of course, the early days were really tough, you know, in the van days, you know, because we were pulling really long rides, you know, for years and years and years and years and years. But they were still great. You know, there's always those long night drives where everyone else is asleep. And I was always
before the sciatica. Night.
Yeah. Well, luckily I can still drive. It's the other leg.
Yeah.
I like those drives sometimes because I was the only one that could stay awake all night. Everyone else is kind of like morning people. And I'm a night owl. I just am. So I was always the night driver. I would always put on something to chill, like some Jim Croce or some Ben Folds or something, and just have at the wheel all night.
And, yeah.
It was just, so wait, was
you're,
really
so you're getting off stage playing with Slipknot and Shadows mm-hmm. Fall and 80s Kiss, obviously. I mean, obviously 80s mm-hmm. Kiss. And then you're putting on that in the bus, like you're just like rocking out to like Dire Straits, Soldiers Swing. Like
Ben, I feel like you tuned out of the conversation and yeah. like returned at a different part because we moved on.
Yeah, you just went through a time warp. Yeah, there's like, you
can
know,
I go back to the time. Future?
Well, that no, was like when you're in the van by yourself and everyone's sleeping now. But we did have, for the most part, kind of a no distortion rule after shows because it was just like too much. Like, okay, the show's over, no distortion rule.
So, okay, so what's John Denae's go-to no distortion band?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. Everyone kind of likes a lot of the same stuff. We love listening to Pink Floyd, you know, so if, like, kind of, who doesn't, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, are we talking, like early Floyd? Or are we talking more like, you know, The Wall and After, like Gilmore?
I'm into the Gilmore stuff way more.
Me too.
For us, oh, yeah, hands down. But I mean, just all of it, just anything to just kind of mellow out, you know. We both agree a lot on like Toad the Wet Sprocket, for example. We're both big fans of. I love that stuff too. I actually did a record, two records back in the early mid 90s doing that kind of stuff. And I'm singing too. So I was doing like Gin Blossoms, Better Than Ezra, that Tonic, you know, bands like that. And I'm still working on cover bands to this day doing that, those sort of things. I love those songs. And I think that is a lot of influence what turned into Shadows Fall. So I love Cannibal Corpse and I love the Gin Blossom. So why can't I put them together? Who makes the rules, right? Like, why can't I do that?
So it's one part Gin Blossoms and one part, like, I Come Blood.
Yeah.
I love that.
You said, jealousy. You said a couple times that, like, why can't we do this? Which I think is one of the things that comes up all the time is that attitude of, like, there's rules and then there's why are those rules. Did you ever feel like not pressure, but that there was a box in the scene that you guys had to break out of, or was it so open that when you decided that why can't I do this, it was just immediately accepted as this, that's great?
No, there was never really a box in the scene. When the scene was first starting, even before him and I got involved, it was a huge death metal scene around here. The local bands would draw 800-900 people, and it was really strong up here, and that just kind of steamrolled into other things. And then as we started, and then a couple years later you had Killswitch, and then you had All That Remains, and you had Acacia Strain, and then you had and then you've got your Boston bands doing the kind of the same thing, like Unearth, and we all just kind of mashed together at the same time doing something that was a little bit different. Because Boston was huge into hardcore, and Western Mass was huge into death metal, and it just seemed to smash together. Because out in Boston, you had, you know, Tree and Sand Black Church and bands like that, and Slapshot and all the earlier stuff, and it just fit. We would always play shows together with the same bands. It didn't matter who was playing.
What do you think it was about Massachusetts or where you were growing up that fostered that sort of culture, that sort of scene, or that style of music?
Is the superior seafood.
That's actually true. There's lots of
seafood. They say there's something in the water.
Okay.
Because of the seafood.
Yeah. Mercury. Lots of mercury in the
water. Yes, lots of
mercury. Interesting. Lots of mercury.
That's where the metal comes
from. I'll take it.
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I honestly don't know. It's a matter of all the bands coming up just all got along, and there was no rivalry. I've seen some local scenes just, you know, passing through other cities where you've got one band that talks shit about another band, talks about another band, it's like, oh, these guys did this. It was never like that here. It was always like, hey, let's all get together and play a show in somebody's basement. You know, that's just what we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about some of your very early experiences playing in a band? Like, we kind of skipped forward a lot, but I'm interested to hear, you know, like, after you started learning guitar going back, like, what was your first early, band experience, your first project, or maybe your first touring experience?
Well, first project would have been something that was called Desecrator, which later turned into Exhumed, which would have been, I don't know, 90, 91. And it was a thrash death metal kind of thing. That was at the time, was all about that. And the scene, mm-hmm. local scene was strong too. There were a lot of local bands in that scene. And we just tried so hard, tried to do anything. And our drummer, who was really, really terrible at the time, he tried his best, but boy, oh boy, he could not keep time. And he went to a prep school around here, and they were having some like talent show at their gym at this fancy pants prep school. And he was, oh, go to Zona talent show. So you got all these jam bands playing Brown Eyed Girl and, you know, whatever else. And then here we are. Here we are. We're Desecrator. We're here to speed up your day. And we didn't win. Let's just say that.
Tough crowd.
Let's just say we didn't win. And then and then it turned into Exhumed. But the next band, Exhumed, it was we replaced some members and got a little bit better, and we played at the same school. Some friends of ours saw us there and knew the person that booked the club, the local club that had some of the nationals coming in and everything else, and kind of referred us. And we ended up on a show with one of the big local bands and just kind of took off. And before you knew it, here we are, we're open for Obituary, and we're opening for Fear Factory, we're opening for whoever else was coming through, and just build. And it was a great time. And we would go anywhere and everywhere we could. And we would go to see all the shows, too. It didn't matter. It was, DSI's at Salisbury Beach. Oh, it's only 4 hours away. Let's go, you know? Mm-hmm. Car and go. But, of course, now, like, oh, it's 4 minutes down the road. Nah, I'm going to sit on the couch.
Right, yeah.
But back then, it didn't matter.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the band that I play in, as a string player, I'm spoiled. You know, I joined when they had the budget for strings. But it's interesting talking about touring, you know, and now we're on, when we do our normal headline tours, we have two buses. And, you know, it's funny talking to the guys because they obviously went through the whole gamut of, you know, different levels of driving in a van and, you know, having to take turns doing these long overnight drives. And they speak about it with such nostalgia. And like, I almost feel like they really enjoyed those days. And it's funny, you know, the outside perspective touring, it's like, oh, the more you have, the better it is, which in a lot of ways is true. But I think some of the most fun times are definitely like, you know, when you are still kind of hustling a bit. And it's so cool to hear those stories from different people that, you know, especially bands that are building from the ground up, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just like anything else. You appreciate it more when you work for it, right? So something's just handed to you and just like, oh, cool, thanks, here's this thing.
But sure.
You spend 3 years trying to obtain that thing, it means more and it sticks with you for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben, you look like you tuned out a little bit there.
No, I was trying to be quiet for you guys because, you know, like Matt, like
he's bored with me.
Once he stops talking, he's bored. Let's be honest.
No, I'm not bored.
That's a first.
In fact, a lot of the times I have to be like multitasking so that I can like even pay attention. So like I listen and I absorb. So when I'm talking, a lot of the times is usually when I'm not listening. So if I'm not talking and I look like I'm distracted, it's usually when I'm listening. It's very disconcerting. It's hard to understand. So, like, basically, if I seem engaged, it's probably a lie. And if I seem disengaged, it's like when I go to a show, I realized the other day I went and saw Guns N' Roses and Green Day. And I loved it. Like, I really loved it because Guns N' Roses, once they, like, tuned in, like, 40 minutes in, it was unbelievable. Green Day, the difference being between, like, Guns N' Roses, where Axl, first off, still sounds like he's an Olympic-level singer and Slash rewrites those solos every night perfectly. Green Day puts on a show. They're like, mm-hmm. you know, from the first song coming out with a bunny rabbit and blowing shit up. And I realized the whole time, even when Weezer came out and you saw Rivers Cuomo with a fucking serious mullet and just a stash and like a fucking 80s leather jacket and a crackled Jackson. The whole time I'm sitting there like this and I was having the best time. So like you would never know because if you saw me, like you would think that guy is a curmudgeonly old piece of shit. Meanwhile, I'm like, huh. 1994, Dookie, I was all by myself in my mind. So if I look like that, it's usually because I'm liking Green Day.
Right on. I had one question that I wanted. In my Wikipedia research, which you have a Wikipedia, which is always very exciting. Like, congratulations on that. Lord.
Oh, yeah. I know everything it says.
Did you write it?
Is it written by Tim Osmond?
I don't know that guy. I heard he's a... But, I don't know that
it's
guy.
It's written in a very suspicious, like perspective. But either way, there's
I definitely didn't write it, but most of that information is incorrect.
Well,
and
so that's why
I don't bother to change it because it's nobody's business, right?
Right, right.
No one needs to know what my birthday is. I can guarantee you that is not correct. But no one needs to know.
There's a mention of Lifeless Records.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your label?
It wasn't like a label.
What I want to ask you because there's like all this talk of like I have a label itself, you know, self-release. Like what did that mean to you? Why did you put a name to what you were doing and what was Lifeless Records to you?
Well, it was something just initially to get that first Shadows Fall album out, the one that had Philip Bonta singing on it. And with that and when we were doing shows, I'm trading demos and tapes with people. I just loved helping other bands. So I did put a few things out, you know, on that label and found some minor distribution and just kind of got things out there. It wasn't like it wasn't any major record stores. It was more like underground tape trading, but with a boost because I had the resources from, you know, traveling and knowing a bunch of different people. It's like, hey, let's put something together. But what I would do, mostly what I did with that was I did some compilation albums for the New England Metal Fest and I had a hand in helping start the very, very first one. And so at that, I would collect all the demos that I got at shows of kids like, hey, check my band out. I'd go home with trash bags full of tapes. And I'd check them out and see, okay, well, let's contact them. And I would put them on I'd make a compilation CD. And by the last one, I think I had 100 bands on the last one. It was like 5 disc set or whatever. And you'd sell them for like $10. So the bands I'd give them they would like send me some money up front to help pay for the manufacturing. Then I would send them a bunch of copies of the finished product. They could sell at their shows and they could make their money back. So break even. But in return, what they're getting now is they're getting that those 100 other bands are doing the same thing in their markets and their thing. So now all these other people are hearing their band with all their contact info inside the liner notes. So it was more of a way of networking that...
Like a pyramid scheme?
Well, I mean... I
no! Really,
I didn't really make any money. Anyway,
I'm just kidding, dude. Someone has to make money for that. We know there's no money in music. Come on. Well, clearly. That's a joke.
Especially well, it's like the original playlist. Like now, you know, people make playlists on Spotify, whatever you share. And then it's like, oh, okay. That's, you know, how people discover. So it's interesting how you did that.
That was a different time, though, when people actually appreciated songs, though.
No, right. Of course. Well, that's what I'm saying. This is before
that. Do you remember,
Matt?
Like, so it went from... I remember back in the day, people bought stuff. And then you're like, you were happy. And then you gave stuff to people. And if you gave it to them, it's like, oh, I gave you a promotional copy and you felt cool. Then there came a point where I found like I was chasing people to give out like CDs I'd burned and put like the Staples logo on myself with the tape thing. Mm-hmm. And you'd go always as you leave the club and there's 4 of those CDs that you printed for $1.47 yourself in the fucking trash.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you see that decline and what did that look like from you? From people valuing music to basically burning CDs yourself and like chasing people and they still don't want to listen to it?
It went way too fast. It changed like that. It was gone. It was gone. And there was really no way to keep up with it, I think, you know. So I still like to help, you know, other bands on a level that I can, but, you know, doing it that way isn't going to work. Because, like, you know, I work with Carnivora out of Salem, and so I produced their album and have been working with them in a kind of a management level kind of role, I guess, just kind of guiding them into something bigger, because I believe in the band. They remind me of me 20 years ago. Like, all right, I'm going to help these guys out. So I still like to do that. Of course, I have not as much time as I used to, but that's not going to stop. But the way you deliver it is definitely different. You're not going to go to every show. Even the first Shadows Fall, we had big, before our demo came out, we had a singer before Phil, actually, and it's called Damien. And we made a two-song demo. We had a six-song demo. Then we had these other two songs. We went to a Pantera show in Springfield that just handed out tapes. We just dubbed a bunch of cassette tapes and handed them out to everyone in line, you know, and everyone was stoked to receive it, just like you were saying. And now it's like, oh, cool, thanks. And then they just throw it on the grind.
Well, you shouldn't be handing out tapes now. That would be very right. ill-advised, I think. that might have been your mistake.
That's the problem. Yeah, right. You should be handing out tapes.
That's true, though. Actually.
What is this?
I'm going to Google this.
Yeah. So it's definitely a different world, and you have to adapt to it. But it's difficult. It is, because it's moving so quickly. Yeah. So quickly.
Yeah, I remember seeing Shadows Fall, I think, on Fuse. I think you guys had, like, a Fuse TV interview or something. And I was following everything. I was like, this is, like, the pinnacle. The pinnacle. Like, they're on Fuse TV. Like, what... Can you talk about, like, when that next step came, you know, because there's... Did it feel like a steady path, or was there, like, these, like, kind of jumps and steps, right? Oh, now we're in a tour bus, or now we're in this, now we're doing this festival. Like, how'd that feel?
Well, we didn't stop. That was the thing. In the early days, we did not stop. Once we played anywhere and everywhere we could on our own. And then once we had signed with Century Media and we had a booking agent, we started touring. We would do one tour, take 2 weeks off, jump right into another one, week off, do another one, do long weekends, do another one. We were on the road 10 months a year for 5 years straight, easy.
Oh my God.
It just building and building and building. And then playing with everyone we possibly could with this very wide range of bands. You know, the first tour out with, you know, Dismember and Christian and Cataclysm. And then the next tour we're out with Glassjaw and Avenged Sevenfold. And it's just different. But that's what I always thought was cool about what we were doing, is that it kind of fit everywhere. There was no real set, like, oh, these guys belong right here. Because it was a little bit different for the time. And fans of,
I just, you know, I just those realized
bands can get into it and fit. They're definitely
that you have played on tour with three of the greatest drummers that have left our planet way too fast. I think you are like the albatross in the Iron Maiden song for the drummers. We have Joey Jordison gone. We have Vinnie Paul gone. And then, hold on, you had one other guy that I was just thinking about that. Who did you just say you were?
Reverend Jim.
The Rev from Avenged Sevenfold. Thank you. My brain stopped there for a second. The Rev, who was unfucking believable. I mean, Mike Portnoy came in and stepped in for that dude. I mean, if it tells anyone, like, the level. Like, what was it like to watch, like, I guess my question is, being a huge fan of all of those bands, what was it like watching those drummers, and, like, what was the difference between, like, a Joey Jordison and Vinnie Paul and, you know, and watching the Rev, and what were you thinking at the time when you were standing maybe behind the drum riser?
Well, I mean, they were all pros. By the time I had seen Vinnie or Joey, they had already kind of gotten there. But with the Rev, it was different because, you know, we took them out on one of their early tours, like one of their first tours. And people just didn't know what to do with them because, like, these guys are different. We weren't really sure where to put them. Well, come out with us. So we had tons of tours where they were playing with us. And then one really great one was it was Mushroomhead headlining with us, and High on Fire and Avenged Sevenfold was the opening act for like $50 a night, you know. And we toured with those guys, I couldn't tell you how many times. And they're always so grateful even after them when they blew up, you know. They would always call us up and go, like, hey, you guys want to go to Canada? Yes. You know, it was cool. They always return the favor, you know. So I love those guys to death. You know, I've been lucky to have toured with good people that you hear horror stories all the time. I was out in front of this guy and he was a dick, and this guy was a dick, blah, 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 blah. We've never really run into that.
That's amazing.
I'm quite surprised, actually, considering we've been doing it for, you know, 25 years or whatever. It's like, Jesus, we never
not even one in the band. I mean, like, I feel like every band has a dick. I mean, I'm clearly the dick in Lost Symphony, so like, well, we know that. Clearly. So like, I mean,
but you're the dick in any band, right?
Well, no, that's not true. My dad's name is my dad's name's Richard. So the Goodman Band, he's technically the dick, and I'm Ben.
So that's what you inherited from him, man. The title. Okay,
and the nubs.
All right. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it, you know, of course, everyone's got some aggressive people here and there, but you know, you don't really, there's so much going on when you're on tour like that. There's so many things distracting you, and you're getting tugged in every direction. It's like, you got to be at this meet and greet. You got to do this autograph sign. You got to go to an in-store here and there. You got soundcheck right now. You got to go do this. You don't really have time unless you really connect with somebody and spend a lot of time with them, like we do with Joey or, you know, or some other people like that, that to really see that. So I can't really say. And it, obviously everyone has their bad days. You see people blowing and go, wow, that guy looks like an asshole, but you don't know what happened in their life, you know?
It's right.
Like, and it doesn't happen every day. So that can't be true. You know, I'd like to think that everyone's got some good in them somewhere that they don't want to.
I don't know. If you were really playing guy, the real 80s Kiss, you would know better. Because Gene's never nice.
Well, I've never met him, so I do not know.
we're gonna be coming to a close in our first hour pretty soon. But you mentioned you know, how you guys were just working and taking every tour and every gig you get, and kind of on that trajectory. Was there a point where you had your head down and then you looked up and you're like, oh, this shit's working? Like, was there an actual point where that happened, or did it just feel like it's the same thing that you just kept going up and up?
Well, there's definitely a point where things started to grow quicker. Mm-hmm. And that was probably Ozfest 2003. That was a game changer.
What was that like?
Because you could just, there weren't really many bands like us on that. So it was a lot of new metal bands and things like that. And it was, you know, us and Killswitch. So it was for them too. I mean, they'd say the same thing. That would be that tour that really kind of turned the corner. Or people are like, wow, this is different. What is that? It's not the same cookie cutter new metal stuff that's on both stages or being processed out of the label factories, you know? And from there, you know, it just kept going. Cause right after that, in 2004, we had, you know, the Damage Plan tours and all that. In 2005, it was 2005 Ozfest main stage, the Slipknot tour. It just, we didn't stop. But once things started firing, it just went. And we pushed it as far as we possibly could.
And do you, I have to ask you this, because I feel like your band's like one of these bands, like, you know, with All That Remains, is like, why can't you guys do The Fall of Ideal? Or you know, a lot of people were like, The War Within, The War Within. Like, do you feel like, but you guys never stopped like crescendoing your success. Like, do you feel like when you were getting successful, because we're from Massachusetts, we have to fucking heckle you. The people were still like, but your last record was better. Like, you guys should sound like that. Like, did that happen a lot, or do you guys just not give any fucks and nobody cares?
Of course, everyone's gonna say that. Everyone's gonna say, "Well,
make another season of this."
Right, and then if you did make another one of those records that you asked for, then they'd complain and go, "Ooh, so it's just like the last one."
Yeah. Still dissatisfied. Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that you cannot win. So the way to get around that is to just ignore them. Just do
not with load
just do
and
what
reload.
You want.
Because at the end of the day, you're the one that has to play those songs on stage every night. You're the one that has to be happy with them too. And yes, you want to connect with your audience, but you also want to enjoy it too. Because if you're up there and just going through the motions, people can tell. And when they can tell, that's when it starts to die. Because they know you're bored with it, which makes them bored with it. So if you don't do it for you, it's never going to work.
That's such an excellent way to end this episode. Ben, don't derail.
I'm going to start another conversation, right?
No, metaphorical question that we were talking about that I want to know. Do you think that Eric Carr and Joey Jordison have formed the real 80s Kiss in heaven?
I freaking hope so. I sure hope so.
We just got 2020.
So why don't we... Since the information on the Wikipedia may not be up to date,
well, if you want to rattle some of that off, feel free, and then I will decide which information or not.
We'll jump back into it on the next episode.
As far as what you would like to be divulged, what should our listeners know right now? What to keep an eye? Obviously, we got the Shadows Fall reunion show coming up in December, right?
December, yeah.
Which is incredibly exciting. We'll dive into that in the next episode. But anything else right now that you want to tell people about?
Well, I know I've been seeing a lot of Living Wreckage gigs that I need to drive 2.5 hours to.
That's something I would love to get into because that's what we're pushing now. That's the new thing.
And so, I guess we have to stick around for later this week for you to tell us everything. We'll just dive balls deep.
Absolutely. And Wreckage links will be below.
Let's do it.
You guys have been 2020. Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 66, featuring John Denay of Anthrax and Shadows Fall. Check it out.
I remember being in Australia, and that's when we got another milestone news for me was, do you guys want to go on tour with Slipknot and Lamb of God and do arenas? Which I'd never been on an arena tour before.
Yeah. Right.
So I remember Matt and I were roommates in Australia. We're like, what the fuck? Holy shit, we're going to play arenas. So, yeah, and then that April, Slipknot and Lamb of God went out. And that was rock and roll, man. Like, we were all having a good time back then. And then from there, that was Shadows Fall golden year, was 2005. And then after that, we went on tour with Ozfest with Black Sabbath, Maiden, Black Label Society. So that was my holy shit year.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series
about how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app
and subscribe now.